Well, thank you very much, Rob, for that very kind introduction. And more generally, I'd like to thank the Australian Institute of Building for the very kind invitation to speak here today and the opportunity to discuss recent developments in the Australian housing market. I don't really have to tell you that housing is important in our lives in many ways, including as a secure place to live, a key asset, and an important vehicle for saving. Housing is also a source of employment for a lot of people, including for those in the business of developing, building, and renovating, as well as for those who help us to sort of trade and move between dwellings and oversee the legalities, the insurance, and the financing of housing-related transactions. Hardly surprising then that it's a frequent topic of conversation. I'm sure it is here, and it is amongst economists, at least those that I know. And it's not surprising that central bankers pay it very close attention, given that it plays an important role in the business cycle, in the transmission of monetary policy, and as we've seen in many advanced economies of late, in other parts of the world, in the health of the financial system. So my plan today is to try to add to that conversation, reviewing what's been happening over the past year or two, and then discussing some of the factors affecting the outlook for the Australian housing market. So overall, the data over recent months suggests that demand in the established housing market is strengthening, albeit gradually, and this should help to underpin further moderate growth in dwelling construction. So this general strengthening has been helped, no doubt, by 175 basis points worth of cuts to the cash rate since late 2011 and the decline in mortgage interest rates that have followed from these cuts. Now, apart from a brief period after the onset of the global financial crisis, which you can see here, apart from that period, required mortgage payments, which are shown here, on a new home are at the lowest level as a share of disposable income for about a decade. An assessment of what's been happening to housing prices will depend somewhat, though, on which market you're looking at and over what time period. For the country as a whole, and you can see that here in the black line for Australia, for the country as a whole, housing prices have been rising gradually since about May of 2012, and they're now about 4% higher than they were at that time. However, if you were a developer, perhaps who had made plans and purchased land for development sometime around here in October 2010, when housing prices last peaked, then you might be forgiven for focusing on the fact that house prices are still below their previous peaks in many locations. In particular, prices are still quite a way below their peak in Brisbane and in Melbourne. And while prices have been quite flat for a few years in Adelaide, and outside of the capital cities in the mainland states. With interest rates low and housing prices having picked up in much of the country, more people are now confident that either house prices will keep rising or at least not decline further. We can see this in some of the available survey measures of housing price expectations. Of course, this is important for prospective entrants to the market, particularly for developers as well as investors who might otherwise be quite wary of undertaking a new venture or purchasing a house for fear of a capital loss. But again, not all markets across the country are in the same boat. In Melbourne, for example, there's some question as to whether supply has moved ahead of demand, particularly in the market for apartments in the inner city area there. And this possibility is certainly consistent with the fact that prices for houses and units in Melbourne are quite a bit lower than the peaks of early 2011. Now, the general improvement in sentiment is also apparent in auction clearance rates. After falling sharply in 2011, these rates recovered to around average levels in both Sydney and Melbourne, and they appear to have increased further early this year. So this move may in part have been helped by a tendency of vendors to adopt more realistic expectations about what their house was worth. and that's evidenced by a rise in vendor discounts. That's the difference between what a property sells for and then what it's actually listed for. These discounts had risen quite gradually as the market weakened through 2011, but more recently, the degree of vendor discounting has returned to more normal levels. Now, as this chart shows, despite the improvement in conditions in the established housing market, turnover, as shown here, as a share of the dwelling stock, turnover remains quite low, at least by comparison with most of the previous decade. You have to go back quite some way to find turnover at this level, as the early 1990s, as far back as that. However, it may be the experience... it's low, at least by comparison with the most previous decade, but that it may be that that experience, the experience of that era, is not the right comparison. Perhaps we shouldn't expect to see turnover sustained at these sorts of high rates again. And if that's right, it means that those who make a living from turnover, well, that's real estate agents, they're the most obvious example I can think of, they're unlikely to see a return to the easier days of the first half of the previous decade. Over the past 20 years or so, upturns in the housing market have been accompanied by an increase in the growth rate of credit. But those years were also a period of structural change. And you can get that impression from this chart. So those years were a period of structural change as the economy moved to a level of higher household indebtedness. Generations of households yet to buy their first home or still wanting to trade up were taking advantage in this earlier period of easier access to credit, which amongst other things had been facilitated by the shift to lower inflation and lower interest rates in the early 1990s. So as part of this change, the household savings rate declined and house prices increased at times quite rapidly. In any case, with household indebtedness no longer moving higher since about 2006, this long period of adjustment you can see here, that long period of adjustment now seems to have run its course. Indeed, in recent years we've seen a rise in household savings, the household savings rate, and relatively stable household debt as a share of income. And this suggests that we should not expect housing credit to grow anywhere near as rapidly as it had in previous upturns. Moreover, while the recent pickup in housing prices would tend to imply growth in housing loans, since buyers who purchase those loans, purchase those properties with higher prices typically fund that with debt, the effect of that will be lessened by the low level of the turnover that I showed earlier. So we might not expect loans to be going up as rapidly as they might otherwise. In any case, the availability of credit does not appear to be a constraint for most home buyers and investors. I think you get an impression of that here. The decline in mortgage interest rates since 2011, that's underpinned a moderate increase in the value of total housing loan approvals over the past 6 months or so. So here we see in the total, and then we can see in some of the components this movement over the past 6 months. So that's clearly been driven by a demand from repeat buyer owner occupiers in the green, and then investors as well in the blue there. Despite the moderate pickup in new lending, growth in housing credit has not increased significantly. That remains broadly in line with growth in incomes, which is at an annual rate of around 4.5%. Lower interest rates have certainly given households more scope to make payments on their mortgages just ahead of schedule. And what that means is that for a given rate of growth of new lending, credit growth will be a bit lower than otherwise because the existing stock of creditors are paying down their mortgages ahead of schedule. Anyway, we can see this effect in the behaviour of owner-occupier housing credit. So if we look down here, we can see since about that time, the growth rate, when interest rates started to ease, the growth rate of owner-occupier housing credit has fallen below that of investors. So this makes sense, of course, because the incentive to make excess mortgage payments is much greater for owner-occupiers than investors, given the different tax incentives they face. And while finance is available to households on a relatively favourable terms, some developers, they continue to report difficulties in obtaining finance for new construction, with banks requiring a higher proportion of pre-sales than was typical prior to the global financial crisis. Indeed, according to the Reserve Bank's industry liaison, large developers, those that have a good reputation and a strong balance sheet, they have access to credit, while it's the small developers that have tended to experience these more difficult borrowing conditions. The availability and relatively low cost of finance, though, for home purchases, combined with improving conditions in the established housing market, that has been supporting dwelling construction in the last couple of quarters. And the expectation is that dwelling investment will continue to pick up from here. However, it's really hard to know how strong this pickup is likely to be, so let me try and address that point now. This is a chart that shows private residential building approvals, which, though quite volatile, as you can see, from month to month, and hence I've put a trend line through there to try and peer through that volatility, they have picked up noticeably from their trough in early 2012. So you can see this movement here. So this recovery has been driven by an increase in the higher density approvals. We can see that down here in the green, and that's mainly apartments, and that sort of movement was seen in all of the largest states across the country. Indeed, when you peer through, and if you want to have a look at the speech we released on the website where these graphs reside, but they were really too detailed to show here tonight, and get them all, and absorb them all, across what they show is that across almost every major region in Sydney, building approvals since the middle of last year have been higher than they were in the previous 5 years. In Melbourne, approvals have also picked up, though by somewhat less and not across all regions. There's been some pickup in approvals in WA, although changes in the building approvals process there around the middle of last year make it more difficult to discern the underlying trends. And then approvals in Queensland, they have been subdued, particularly on the Gold Coast and in the southeast of the state more generally. However, even builders in that region have told us that there are tentative signs of some improvement in demand more recently. So while the approvals for higher density housing here have picked up, as yet there's been little sign of a rise in approvals for detached houses. So you can see that in the blue line here, which is still really pretty flat over that same period. So building approvals for detached houses, they're currently at levels seen during all these low points of previous cyclical downturns. So that's what's happening for detached houses, whereas for higher density housing, the level's kind of around some of these previous cyclical highs. So what that suggests to me is that it may be an early indication of a new trend in the housing market. And there are a number of reasons why we might have expected this shift. First, of course, as the price of land has increased relative to incomes over the past few decades, it makes sense then that people have an incentive to economise on their use of land, and they can do that by living in higher density housing. So that's the first point. The second point, I guess, is that it may be that the utility of living in detached houses on the fringes of many cities, that has decreased with increased congestion and the difficulties that it implies for travelling into cities to access job and other opportunities there. And third, and really closely related to that idea, is the possibility that there may have been a shift, a real wholesale shift in people's preferences towards living closer to the centre of cities and closer to existing infrastructure there. In any case, if that is a durable structural change in the market, it'll have important implications for builders and developers, particularly those whose business model is really focused just on the detached housing side of things. Now, to understand what the strength of the increase in overall residential construction activity is likely to be in the future, I think it's helpful to just really take a step back from the most recent few months worth of data and try and look at developments over a slightly longer period. That's what I'm trying to do in this chart here. So this is private dwelling investment as a share of nominal GDP. And the thing that really stands out over the past few years is this trend. And that despite this recent pickup in the past couple of quarters, dwelling investment as a share of the economy remains close to the troughs of over a decade ago. So this relatively low level of dwelling construction then, at least in my mind, raises the question of whether demand's been particularly weak or whether it's supply issues that have constrained construction activity. So factors affecting the supply of land for development, they're obviously going to have an important bearing on the cost of new housing and the speed with which supply can respond to any increase in demand. I'll come back to a discussion of some of these factors in just a minute. But the key point I want to make now is just that whatever these supply-side constraints might be, they don't seem to have prevented an increase in construction across much of the country in 2009 and 2010. At that time, there was a general increase, of course, in incentives for first-home buyers for both new and existing dwellings, and the support was provided for a time by lower interest rates, and that combined led to a sharp run-up in construction in New South Wales, in Victoria, in Queensland, in WA. Further evidence that the supply of land is really not the whole story can be found by looking across various different regions within the states. And that's what this chart attempts to do. Now, if supply was indeed the critical constraint, we might have expected construction trends to have been quite different across inner, outer parts of the cities and the regional areas beyond the cities. For example, development in the outer suburbs, as you know, tends to be on greenfield land, while development in the inner suburbs tends to be higher density dwellings on brownfield land. If we focus on Victoria for a moment, the pickup there in building activity in 2009 and 10, that was relatively broad-based across these areas. Some outside of the city of Melbourne, quite a lot on the outer region, and then quite a lot as well in the inner and middle region. For New South Wales, it does appear that there was a larger and more sustained pickup in approvals here in the inner and middle region of the city of Sydney than in outer Sydney and the rest of the state. Of course, that may have reflected some limitations in access to land on Sydney's fringes, but nonetheless, there was a relatively rapid pickup in approvals in 2009, even on the outer regions and the rest of New South Wales. Now, so even so, this doesn't mean that supply-side issues have not had a very important bearing on the housing sector. This point was made in research published by the bank in a bulletin article last year. Many public reports at the time and the bank's own liaison with industry participants, that all pointed to a range of the supply-side impediments in the Australian housing market. So what are they? They included the length and complexity of the planning process, the provision and funding of infrastructure, land ownership and geographical constraints, as well as challenges for development within those city regions that are already well developed. And while these factors may impose some constraints on the cost and responsiveness of new supply, it's less clear, though, that they've been restraining the level of new construction more so now than in the recent past, than in the past. Now, one way that's often used, and perhaps you've heard of it, one way that's used to assess the possible outlook for dwelling construction is to compare the number of dwellings that have been built over a period of time with a measure of what people call underlying demand. So the notion here is if you can assess the prospects for the average number of people living in a given house, and then you can gauge the strength of underlying demand by saying something about what's happening to population growth. And the problem with this sort of analysis is that the average number of people in each household changes over time, including in response to a range of things, such as the cost of housing itself. So If we look over the 20th century, demographic and social factors such as the declining birth rate, rising separation rate, they were accommodated by growth in the dwelling stock outpacing that of the population. In other words, there was a downward trend here in the number of people living in each household. And a very similar change was also evident across the advanced economies. Here I've just picked a selection of countries that don't feel that different to Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK and the US. However, over the past decade or so, particularly in Australia, those sorts of trends, those downward trends, have abated, and we've seen the average household size stabilise. Indeed, the higher level of house prices and rents, which I'll come to in a moment, they may have been somewhat of a constraint on household formation and therefore on the demand for housing. So I'm not sure what we can gain from that methodology, which assumes often that we know what these trends or movements in the average number of people is going to be. So this leads me to what I think is arguably a better way to judge the strength of demand versus supply, which is really just to look at prices and what prices and rents have been doing. And what this suggests is that demand has shown signs of strengthening relative supply. So in particular, if we look at house prices, well, the point I would make is they're no longer falling relative to incomes. There's been a period of stabilisation. Also, the rental market, broadly speaking, appears to be relatively tight. So vacancy rates have been quite low from about here compared to where sort of averages from the early 90s, sort of these sort of levels. And from 2006, with a small delay, the ratio of rents to income have been rising to be at a higher level. And they've been quite stable at that level, somewhere around previous sort of high points. And then the growth in rents has also meant that conditions for investors have become more favourable. And we can see that in the lower panel here with rental yields increasing across capital cities. So our liaison with industry confirms that the demand for new housing has been more positive over recent months. At the same time, however, our contacts note that conditions still remain relatively subdued in most states. In particular, they report that prices for the construction, the cost of actually building the house, putting the house up, prices for construction of new dwellings have been held down in response to weak demand, with discounting still reported across the market, including for new developments. Not surprisingly, developers have found a lack of buyer urgency during the earlier period of declining dwelling prices. And in addition, they note instances of some earlier sales made off the plan falling through ahead of settlement, apparently due to caution by lenders regarding valuations and strict lending practices for new developments. So let me conclude then, just try to draw a few of these threads together. So a range of indicators suggest that low interest rates have been supporting the established housing market, and prices have been moving higher in many markets, although they remain below earlier peaks in most. Also, finance is available on reasonable terms for households, and with these conditions in place, dwelling construction is beginning to pick up, and leading indicators point to further growth in the months ahead. In line with that, our expectation is there will be a further gradual increase in dwelling construction activity over this year and next. This moderate growth in dwelling investment will play some role in helping to support a gradual pickup in economic growth more broadly from what's expected to be a rate a little below trend this year. But it's hard to know exactly how strong the recovery in the housing market might be, so that's something we'll continue to analyse closely over the period ahead. So thank you. Perhaps you can have some questions now. Yeah, I mean, you have to do the calculation to think too about the. I don't know if that's taking account of what sort of tax relief you get on paying for the interest. I mean, it tells us, I mean, I think it's that's certainly been important in people's minds when thinking about sort of the situation when they face the possibility of a capital loss. And that's why I think the possibility and the expectation that prices might not fall further, at least in most parts, really will play an important role. You may not need much of an expectation of at least a small capital gain to sort of turn that calculation around. That's probably an important part of that calculation.
David Alessian from High Budge for a construction development company. One thing that's always intriguing about the facts and figures, particularly in New South Wales, when things are quiet, councils quite often have less of a backlog and get approvals through much quicker. When things are busy, the approval times are much longer. Are these figures correct for those approval times in councils to some extent?
Let me see. So, well, these don't tell you anything about how long they've been sitting waiting for approval. What these do is tell you when the paperwork's been processed and the thing's been approved, and then the ABS will then collect all that information from all the various local councils and amalgamate it together. So you're right, this doesn't really give you an indication of what you're talking about, which sounds sensible, right? Unless the council's put on a lot more people and process these things when it moves up, one imagines it takes them a bit longer to process with the same number of people, a much higher increase in paperwork, so to speak.
Actually, to take that point, you're talking about supply and demand imbalance and the supply lag which might occur from those circumstances. Do you think that's all out of time in the day?
Well, I think what I was trying to do, this is probably the most useful one. It doesn't really tell me. I guess you would often expect, at least I would, that demand moves a bit faster than supply. People can just show up and, whether in the established or for new housing, say, I'd like to sort of jump in and I've been holding off, perhaps. So that can move up quite quickly, one imagines. And then you'd expect if supply is not responding very quickly, then prices start to move higher. And indeed, that brings forth sometimes not only more supply, but sometimes a bit more demand, because we overcome the problem that was suggested here, that certainly if there had been fears of capital losses, once people see their way through that, they think prices are on the move up, they might come forth as well. So you can imagine you get a bit of this momentum at the early part of the cycle, and then you can get what's often called sort of a hog cycle, where it takes a little while for supply to come on stream, prices keep going for a while, it brings forth more supply, the plans are made, the land is bought, the approvals processes are proceeding, and then it turns out there's more supply than you had really wanted. So this has always been a problem for property markets, that you don't realise that till some latter point. These are critical issues as to how much land has been provided one way or another. And the striking things for me is I would have thought, at least from my somewhat amateur perspective on this point at least, that it would have been quite hard to generate a lot of approvals in inner and middle regions. But in fact, that's not the case in Sydney, nor is it the case in Melbourne. And then in Melbourne, they've done a lot to encourage a lot of increase in supply in the outer regions. And if you've been to Melbourne of late, you can kind of see the evidence of that. In Sydney, there was less of that. And what we never know, of course, is, well, is that because supply was constrained? And what we hear is, yes, somewhat, in some locations, not necessarily all. There might not have been as much land as people wanted in the right locations. But it may have been that. It may have just been a sort of the demand wasn't there to sustain it and keep it going. It's always very hard to tell.
We're talking about swipe or the other things at UTS. Tied in with what you're talking about with Melbourne. Melbourne, particularly as a city, went through a process of identifying through its planning, its sort of general sort of approach, where they wanted to expand strategically. Mm. There was an acquisition process in terms of land that occurred in the sort of fingers that went out from the heart of the city. So that obviously is going to impact on that sort of dynamic, because it's created that stream of sort of suburban expansion, which we haven't seen in quite the same way in sort of a different political model and a different planning model here in New South Wales. So that's presumably going to impact on that sort of flow that you're getting the differential between Melbourne and the Sydney models. But more importantly, have you mapped at all and deconstructed any of these graphs to tie in with politics and the fact that there's been changed politics between sort of states which were held under Labour governments and now the move of the states towards Liberal governments and the impact that we may see of the flow-on effect for supply stream in the flow-on of potential expansion?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. We haven't sort of looked in it in that way. I mean, we do, particularly through our liaison program, so we're out speaking a lot, not just to builders and the like, but also and developers, but also to government authorities one way or another. You know, we do try to sort of pick up what are these various trends happening in different parts, and even in Sydney, in the outer regions, there are quite important differences between, say, in the south and then in the north. But in terms of your question, I couldn't really add anything because it's not something we're sort of focused on too much.
Very interesting to map that sort of political dynamic and the change of governments that we've seen state level versus federal.
I suspect there may even be more intricate things going on even within councils, having exposure to sort of some of those just through the local papers I read. There's some differences even across councils.
Well, Chris, are these trends you're talking about in housing construction, are they sufficiently strong enough to increase your level of optimism about the moment in time in the future when the mining investment boom occurs and the building sector needs to step up and do some heavy lifting for growth?
So they make a modest contribution in our forecasts to the sort of gradual pickup in growth we're forecasting. Sort of this year we have growth a little below trend and then picking up gradually into the next year, 2014. So they make a contribution throughout the period in terms of our forecasts. It's reasonably modest, and the challenge, though, is to, you know, it's easier to model and think about what our approvals might be doing, how that might translate into activity like the dwelling investment numbers I showed you. The more challenging aspect is to think about all the other effects that come from improvements in the established housing market. As prices go up, people feel a bit wealthy, and there does seem to be somewhat, we shouldn't overstate it, but something of a wealth effect. Households feel a little bit better about life and their spending plans, whether it be on dwelling investment or other expenditure when prices are going up. That's a very hard effect to sort of capture properly when you're sort of modelling these things. And then the other thing that's very hard is all of these other knock-on effects, because there'll be some dwelling investment, but some of that investment in terms of the material might be supplied by domestic manufacturers, for example. So those things are hard to capture. I think there'll be a modest contribution from dwelling investment, but it's not the sort of full story of this pickup in this gradual pickup in growth that we've been talking about in terms of our forecasts. There are other elements to that.
And also the, I don't think you speak about the land of the job market, but they come, what's a big factor in determining the strength of the housing market. Can I just get a sense of how you view the job market right now, without being concerned about rising unemployment, without seeing the number today, and
yeah, so our forecast had been for a very gradual edging higher in the unemployment rate. That was predicated on partly on the forecast for GDP growth being a little below trend this year. In terms of the current, you know, the data out today, that looks to have been quite a bit better. I think better than many in the markets had expected. There's no denying that. The challenge, of course, is what does that mean in terms of new trends? I think it's 1 month's data. It's not to be denied, but the data is noisy. And indeed, the ABS said part of this increase in the month, which was quite strong, about 70,000 extra jobs in the month, part of that was a sort of sample rotation, which is a statistical issue that might not suggest that that's the underlying trend is quite as strong as that. but it's a positive number, and you know, it the unemployment rate now has been relatively stable for a few months. So,
how many more months of jobs
Oh, well, that's a good question. I think, you know, I wouldn't have an exact number, and it's going to be very hard to sort of predict. I would pause for a minute to think we don't want to turn things around on the basis of 1 month's number, particularly as I referred to some of these number might be overstated. Unemployment rate has still drifted a bit higher over the past year. Average hours are still a little lower than the last year. Leading indicators of employment, the vacancies numbers, whether it's the ABS or the ANZ measures or some of the other measures that are around there, they still have moved kind of lower. Now, some of them are just turning. We'll get some ABS numbers next week. So you don't want to hinge too much on 1 month's number, and the labour market's very important, but it's not the full story, so you'd want to sort of be looking at a range of other indicators before you sort of made that call.
Yeah, Chris, so I apologise, I missed the presentation. Did you have any breakdown there, say, of we're looking at purchases of tiny apartments and such? What proportion were local buyers versus overseas buyers, and how that actually might affect the trends? Because if you go into any display suite, anywhere around the city, or certainly in the inner region, you know, it's a very strong Asian clientele.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen sort of reliable data on that sort of breakdown. What I pick up is just what we hear through liaison, and we hear a similar message. It's really hard to put a number on it. I think what you're referring to is sort of buyers coming from offshore. I mean, we hear that there's quite a strength of demand for that, and it's really in the apartment markets in the inner cities. I wouldn't be able to put a number on it precisely, not having seen reliable statistics, but it seems to be something that's happening.
Speaking of somebody who's keenly interested in what happens in outer Sydney, do you have any reason why, despite a downturn, a rapid downturn in outer Melbourne activity, it's still so much higher than it is in Sydney? Is it because they're doing multi-residential out there? Is it because the unemployment out of Melbourne is far less than out of Sydney? Is it because it's just damn easier to get around Melbourne from out of Melbourne?
I don't have any really deep insights. I was born in Melbourne, but that's about the extent of it. And then I visit there occasionally. I mean, I think my sense is that, you know, there has been a lot of land released in outer Melbourne, and there's a lot of... they maybe don't face some of the geographical constraints. So my reference there was to Sydney. I think some of them are obvious. You go north and you face some geographical constraints. You go south and you face them. So Melbourne may not have quite that many constraints, so that may be one part of it. But then there may have been this... You know, we had this discussion, maybe they've been more actively pursuing development of these outer regions. However, having said that, I was speaking to somebody in Melbourne who resides in one of these areas on the outer, which has experienced rapid growth, and they are sort of now talking about the same sorts of problems that you might hear if you're more familiar with Sydney in terms of the congestion, the traffic. There's just not enough infrastructure in terms of transport to bring people into the cities quickly during peak hours.
Well, just looking at your figures, I wish I'd paid attention to your first figures in 2008.
Yeah.
I feel I missed out.
I mean, just following up on that, you referred to a very interesting pattern that came out of the Reserve Bank last year. And to what extent is that difference attributable to the different way that Victoria approaches major infrastructure investment versus New South Wales?
I'm no expert on that. I mean, we monitor these sort of these things, but I couldn't tell you the inner workings of exactly why that is. And perhaps you know more than I on that.
But that article you referred to was very interesting on that topic, and raising the much more difficult infrastructure funding regime in New as well.
Yeah.
It's not just an issue of transport congestion.
No.
Things like water.
Sure. No, because we're doing, I think the point you're alluding to is that we're doing infrastructure quite differently to the past. We used to fund in the distant past infrastructure out of sort of general revenues.
Yeah.
And now there's a levy up front that has to be paid up front,
yeah,
you know, by the developer that's passed on to the buyer of that land. Now, if there are no credit constraints and credit was freely available, at a high level, at least at a, in principle, theoretical level, that shouldn't make much difference, right? Because it just means instead of paying a string of taxes to fund it over the future of you, the time you're in that region, you pay it up front.
Yeah.
Well, it shouldn't make a difference, but people are credit constrained and it does make a difference. So, I mean, it's an important issue. I think all of these supply issues, as best we understand, are things that various local authorities, state and local authorities, are conscious of and trying to work towards, but they're difficult, difficult things.
Yeah.
Great. Very diplomatic. You didn't like that paper. I think it was that's the supply side issues paper we're talking about, which looks at margins in Sydney, which are about the housing development, for example. And you didn't take on the National Housing Supply Council and their mission about demand supply balance in the market, which is fabulously diplomatic as well. But what I would like you to give your opinion on is the Economist Global House Price Indexes. And according to the Economist magazine, Australian house prices are heavily overvalued, and they're in the dying throes of a major bubble. And they base that on two principles. They measure house prices by the income to debt measure and the rents to income measure. And they compare Australia to about three dozen other countries. And according to the Economist Index, Australian house prices are about 45% overvalued at this point in time. And I'm just wondering whether you might have an opinion on that.
Something of an opinion. So these are the sorts of things I think you might be referring to in the same... I don't remember the exact date, but recently we've published on this as well, trying to see what's the best way of comparing house price to income ratios, because people often look at that to sort of get a sense of whether how sustainable things are, and they're looking at what's happening in advanced economies where the housing markets really went through a boom, a very big boom bust. So that's what they look at. And then the challenge, which we point out in this article, is it's very hard to get comparable figures. Many of our staff spent long periods of time trying to look through all of the detailed price measures and income measures and try and compare like with like to get these ratios. And when you do that, what you see is, in terms of roughly where we are now, we sit somewhere in the middle of the pack. We're not right at the extreme high ends, nor are we at the extreme lows. Some countries that are at the lower end that jump into my mind are the US and Japan, and there might be various reasons for that. So, you know, I would never sort of say that we couldn't have a fall in house prices, and it's not to be denied that they're not high compared to historical sort of experience if you go back far enough, but that's a phenomenon that's kind of been a global one with easier access to credit. Households have pushed house prices up relative to incomes, but indebtedness has risen. My sense is, as long as you've been through some periods where households have carefully been able to reassess that, they've seen house prices falling, at least they're open to the possibility that they might fall, and they've stopped falling of late. And the much earlier graph I showed you says that in much of the country they're showing some healthy rises, and at least in absolute terms, Sydney's not quite back at the peak, but there are cities that have sort of moved up. So, you know, I think you can make arguments going the other way, that it's not clear cut. It's very hard to pin down. It's not to deny that house prices couldn't fall, but households are out there saying we're being cautious with our debt. We're not taking debt on to the same extent as the past, but we're happy for, you know, we're pushing house prices up. That doesn't suggest at least immediately, that there's a need for house prices to correct down quickly in the way the economist suggests.
Very cool stuff from UTS. Getting to Gerard's question, particularly with multi and high density housing, the model is basically a speculative one where a speculative developer puts a product on the market. And I guess I'm wondering if you've compared that at all with some of the other economies around the world, particularly the likes of the Netherlands or Scandinavia, where they have socialist democracies, and some of those systems actually try to take the speculative risk out to keep housing down, housing prices down. I'm wondering if you've got any opinion or done any analysis of that.
No, I haven't. I mean, so I couldn't point to anything specific there. I guess the one brief comment I would make with regards to Australia, of course, is that developers, in order to get the finance for a really large project, they need to sort of find a number of buyers who will commit to sort of buying off the plan, and then as soon as they can, they try and sort of build that in order to get at least bank finance and the like. So there's still an element of risk there, including if the sale falls through, the off-the-plan sale falls through.
But people have actually committed to off-the-plan and sold before the development's even finished and still made a healthy profit in the last,
sure,
couple of recent years with other times. So, I guess that's the point.
But as for these comparisons, I couldn't sort of add anything there. Oh, that they somehow follow a cycle over a set periodicity or something like that. I wouldn't think like that. I mean, you could imagine if you thought the broader business cycle had some fixed periodicity to it, then some frequency like that. That might make sense, but it's hard to argue in Australia. I mean, we certainly had slower and stronger periods of growth, but we haven't had a sort of traditional recession since the early 1990s. So I think I'd like to sort of understand the fundamental drivers, and rather than just sort of assert that, yes, every 9 years we can expect a downturn and then it'll turn back up again. But having said that, I think there's an element to which when people have seen prices fall and experienced the pain of a capital loss, they remember that for a while. Maybe new people come along who haven't experienced that. And I've done some research that looks at Australia's much earlier experience, and the 1890s was a real housing bubble and a real financial crisis. And people remembered that all the way through to the 1930s, which is why we didn't have the same sort of bubble-like conditions in property and credit in the 1930s in Australia like we did in the previous Depression, because people had very long memories those days of a very cathartic experience. So there might be something to what you say in that regard.
I sort of repeat, Richardson, also from UTS, sort of piggyback on that, Dowell Myers out of USC in the US, he wrote a really interesting paper looking at the demographics and sort of the cycle of the baby boomers going through the different types of housing that they live in, with, you know, being in apartments and then being in family homes, larger family homes. And then currently, the cycle of the baby boomers moving back into cities and into apartments and smaller homes. Do you think that that's influencing the market? Because I noticed that, for example, in Sydney and in Melbourne, both the multifamily housing was the one driving the rise. And I'm new to Australia, so I don't know for sure, but even where I'm living out in Mortlake, every person that I've met out there is someone who's in that generation that's moved from a family home and gone into a multifamily. And so I'd be interested in knowing what your sort of perspective is on that, and if you think that is influencing the cycle, how that's affecting sort of the upper end pricing homes where those people are moving from, because the younger generation doesn't have the money buy those and pay those prices.
So, I mean, it's an excellent question. I'll, I don't really have a lot of hard facts to sort of grab to answer it. I think you're right that that sounds like one of these important demographic trends or shifts in preferences as the population ages. And the greater share of the population aging and aging in reasonably good health. So they might look to, for lifestyle reasons, rather than sort of eking out their days in a very big house, try and move to something that's more central, closer to amenities, closer to the sort of things they want to spend their time doing in life. That may be there. I don't have the facts, at least for Australia, to sort of pinpoint as to how much that might be contributing. But I think that may be part of it, but there can be these other preference shifts. I mean, the other one on the young end of the spectrum that I hear talked about quite a bit is young people don't value cars in the same way that older people do, and there are surveys to back that up. And one of the reasons is time away from their phone or their tablet device is socially dead time. They feel, you know, it's valuable time, they'd rather be doing something else. So maybe for them, less travelling time where you're driving, or at least moving in public transport, might be advantageous. So there's probably things happening on both ends of the market, but it's a good question.
As an extension of that question, sorry, Graham brought up the Institute of Building Studies, as an extension of that question, it's probably just perceived inability of younger generations to be able to afford housing, isn't that indicative of just a long-term affordable trend?
Well, I mean, it's certainly true now that coming back to this chart, you know, house prices are much higher relative to incomes than they used to be. And people often talk about housing affordability. I often like to think, well, if those are the prices people are paying for them, they're finding them affordable. So I know that's not a very satisfactory answer for you, but if it's true that, and this comes back a bit to this other earlier question, if it's true that newer generations who are the ones who will be buying the lower end properties, if they still find them unaffordable, then those prices will have to sort of come back a bit. One imagines there are limits certainly to how much they can borrow sensibly and how much they want to borrow. So there are limits to what this can do. So maybe we're seeing some sort of stabilisation here around some equilibrium, but we don't. It's hard to know that for sure.
It seems like it correlates with your other chart that talks about the lower turnover rate too. So the average, you know, the rates have gone through the roof here. Mm-hmm. That's about the same time you've seen a reduction in turnover rates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also about the same time as this household indebtedness has sort of plateaued as a share of income. So it doesn't look like it's wanting to push dramatically higher, and the credit numbers we've seen of late don't suggest that. Credit's just growing with income. Savings rates are pretty constant, stable around 10%. Households are just sort of spending. Their spending growth is in line with the growth of incomes.
That was like PTSD. I think this one is the scariest chart probably you've got because I used to live in Australia. I bought a house in 1993 when 2.5 to 3 times was what you had to chuff up to be able to get into the housing market. I lived overseas for a while. I came to Sydney, and suddenly thought I'd never get back in the housing market. I rang my bank, and they said, "Spike, coming up to your late 40s, we'll give you a 30-year mortgage. We'll give you 5 times your salary." And how do you service debt on 5 times your salary? It just doesn't stack up in affordability. And you say, well, it's been a problem because you're going to be probably statistically only there for 7 years. And so in that time, it'll balance out. You'll see some growth in your value property. So it doesn't matter to us. It was that period from the early 90s through to the early 2000s where we had this huge escalation. And suddenly, what this chart isn't showing is all the baby boomers who are already in property. They've paid off their mortgage potentially, they didn't leave country while I didn't, and they stay in one place. Over that period, their mortgage may well have been paid off. But what's happened is the Gen Ys, who might be in that situation, just cannot now access that opportunity. So whilst the statistics and so on are interesting that are put up from the economic number crunching, it misses the fact that you've got this group of people who are, the baby boomers are now sort of debt-free or reduced their debt significantly, and it's the next generation who are trying to break in to something which is such a quantum leap in income to price ratio. And that seems to be profoundly irresponsible of banks to have allowed that to happen.
Well, I mean, I can't comment on the specifics of some of those numbers you talked about, but I mean, and banks need to sort of lend carefully and prudently and assess people's capacity to repay those, and not to anticipate need to require a big capital gain so that when you trade off, you've got some equity there that you can capture. Overall, I think Australian banks sort of, broadly speaking, lending quite sensibly, and we saw that in terms of the comparison between what happened here and what's happened in countries where that was much less the case. I think the other thing I'd say, though, this is, I think you're touching really on the point I was trying to make, that there has been a structural shift here that's having important effects, and one of the effects is land is a lot more expensive than it used to be. That's what this is saying, this chart. And so as housing prices rise relative to income, people have an incentive, particularly the new generation, to try and economise on the thing which is going to cost them a lot. It's going to cost them a lot in terms of paying off a large debt if they tried to sort of come in. So they're going to economise on some of these sorts of things, and the way they do that is live in higher density housing, buy less patch of land and live in an apartment on shared amongst many. So we've seen that. It's really early days to say that's a sustained trend in terms of the chart I showed earlier, going back to this one. You know, I think there's a lot to be said that higher density housing now is at cyclical peaks compared to the past, and detached housing at cyclical lows. And that story might capture part of that. We'll need. I'd like more time and more data to know how durable that's going to be.
Okay. Have you other charts that you've brought out often to show that housing
the interest payments one? Yeah, this one. Describe it as a distortion. I think the point that's been made, that you made and was made just a bit before about older people carrying a mortgage, or people carrying a mortgage much later into life than previous generations, I think you do see evidence of that in the data. When you look at that, you can peer through things like the HILDA data, which is a wonderful source that tracks people through time, and you can see evidence of those sorts of things in that data. So, and that is partly a function of banks know people are working a bit, can work a bit longer, they're working healthier through their lives. The banks may be making a calculation, it's fine, because the expectation is that person can then sell the house if they need to, if they don't want to carry that debt once they're retired or they have other means to pay it off. So all of that's happening. I don't know that that's because of distortions. I don't think it's because banks are being particularly sort of profligate with their lending standards and so on. I don't think they've eased off dramatically. I don't think they've changed much at all, and Australian households on average are sort of meeting their mortgage payments, and banks' losses on mortgages and the like haven't really changed dramatically. They've been coming off as interest rates have eased more recently. So it's not clear that there's an obvious sort of problem there looking for a solution, but I hear what you're saying, that and maybe time will tell, but it doesn't appear that there's a distortion that needs to be addressed. Yeah, with those holding debt. Yeah, I think that's right. There are more people who are maybe taking on debt later in life because of this rise in, you know, what you have to save for a deposit and so on as a share of your income. Might take longer to save that deposit. And then there at the other end, there are older people who are able, the banks are just are willing and able to lend to them because they think there are a reasonable opportunity and a reasonable risk. It may have just been in the past, there was just a hard, fast rule. There's no way you can walk through my doors and get a loan over a particular age. I just won't do it. Whereas, you know, surely it's a good thing that if someone can demonstrate the ability to pay that loan and make those payments, that they can then they can get that access to credit.
Hey. Just going back to the chart that showed the rates for the median, also the higher density in the individual dwelling.
The building approvals, yeah.
That's right. I guess that purple line, the detached, and the green line, high density, they're getting pretty close. I guess the Great Australian Dream of a quarter acre block is diminishing.
Perth is the only city with more detached houses than high density in Australia.
So in Sydney, will those lines meet? Would be the question.
They may well. I'm sorry. Those data are available. I just don't have them at my fingertips. But I mean, that's a distinctive possibility. If what I suggested might be the early signs of a trend continue. And it need not be all high-rise, right? We could be just talking about higher density that isn't all apartments.
A couple of times, I'm sorry, Paul Zanara from ETS. A couple of times in your answers, you referred back to price signals in providing guidance as to where things are going, rather than looking at some of the underlying factors. For example, you spoke about the number of people per household, persons per dwelling, as ABS calls it, as being rather unreliable. And I don't think this is a nerdy technical sort of an argument, because there's policy decisions being made on the difference between what's supposed to be underlying supply and demand versus what we're seeing. So in one case we see price signals versus things like population growth and people per household. Price signals are incredibly noisy and volatile. The trends in people per household relatively stable, it doesn't change dramatically. You can predict, you can follow a trend over a relatively longer period. So my interest is, in the policy advice that you provide, how important are policy signals versus some of the underlying factors?
Well, these are underlying things are critical to driving sort of demand, don't get me wrong, but I was trying to make the point that measuring sort of underlying demand in a rigorous way and getting the level of we need to build this many houses so we can accommodate this many people per house. And you can get this very small variations in this sort of number and then multiply that by the number of the growth of the population, and suddenly you can get big changes in the total numbers. And therefore, if you compare that to what we've actually built, you know, some people might say, oh, we haven't been building enough houses by this order of magnitude, but you change this number just a little bit, or you change the forecast and you imagined, oh no, this is a trend, I've seen it here, I've seen it everywhere, and back here it's going to continue, and it doesn't, or it perturbates just a little bit. It can have quite a big effect in terms of your assessment of, oh, no longer do I think we've been underbuilding by large multiple thousands and thousands of houses per year, and we're building up a gap there of sort of pent-up demand, if you like. So you can't quite get that nuance from this chart because it looks so smooth, and this is sort of drawn between, I think, census years. But my point is that you can get small changes in the number of people per household, and that can quickly accommodate sort of the number of people that we have who need a house with existing housing stock. So I guess that's the point I was trying to make. And therefore, if I'm just looking in the last year or two about, do I think there's this huge pent-up demand for housing because I don't feel like we've been building enough relative to the population growth and making assumptions about this, or is it really small or is in fact not there at all? Well, I find that hard to judge. But if I see quantities going up and prices going up in a market, I've got the sense that it's demand that's moving more than supply. If I see quantities going up and prices not going up so much, I think maybe supply is doing more of the movement. And that's the point I was trying to make, which is a really sort of simple economic argument. But it's a good observation that, yes, this does look quite stable, but I think many people would be surprised that it had stabilised, and part of that may be because people are finding the prices high and responding accordingly.
Well, can I just follow on from this? If you look at the percentage change in the number of households, which this doesn't tell you, but if you compare percentage change in households to the number of new dwellings delivered every year, they match up really well. Over the last 10 years, there's a pretty close match between them, which is interesting because it doesn't indicate that there's excessive under and over supply. And you think if there was an imbalance in that marketplace, then one or the other of those would be running at a much higher rate than the other. So I think the fact this is levelled off and the fact that approvals are still kind of along the trend lines at the moment would indicate that the market's reasonably balanced at the moment. Prices would indicate that as well, going on from what
this. Yeah, I mean, that's true. And I guess the point here was just to say, look, these haven't changed much, but they're just those vacancy rates, right? At the moment, they're around 2, a bit higher than the low point here, but they're certainly, on average, lower than they have been, and that just suggests there's some tightness. Whether you want to characterise that as a lot or just some, I'd probably say there's some tightness. That's helped move rents higher as a share of income, picked up a little bit the rental yields, and that's just the sense in which you think there might have been some tightness there in the market with demand sort of starting to sort of, you know, relative to supply, show some expansion. But it's
in a perfect market, the cost to rent and the cost to loan would be the same for the equivalent. In a perfect market. But clearly the market's not perfect.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of other factors. So that's a long road, in my opinion.
Yeah, I guess I'm just trying to say there's some indications, and they're not perfect, that there's not a massive imbalance, but there's some tightness there. And one imagines at least there are the conditions with interest rates low, prices having moved higher of late, and expectations that prices won't fall, if not rise somewhat, and rents moving higher. Those are the sort of conditions that would suggest dwelling construction, there's a bit more down the track. And that, I guess that's the main point I was trying to make, rather than put a precise number on things.
Well, I think your suggestion is because you're missing the notions of capital growth, and you're not taking out money from your rent or your rental allocation to put into a sinking fund to match the capital component as opposed to the rental component. So you should have rent at a lower level to reflect the fact you're creating a sinking fund of some sort to match that at the end of a period of 30 years or 99 years, you are able to replace that asset in a different way. That's a whole bunch. Surely that's a part of the basis of sort of rental theory, that you're setting aside a component of sinking fund. So you've got to have your rental payments and your sinking fund, which means that the price will have to bear for the cost to own. The cost of rent is going to be less than the cost to own.
My further question,
you
look at the relativity of income to housing affordability, and I think one fact that can be overlooked is the huge intergenerational wealth transfer that we see in a lot of that's tied up in housing, where a lot of established housing is passing through its fourth and fifth generation. That doesn't bear as much relativity to the income because the parties that are receiving it debt-free as it passes through those generations. And I think that there's elements of that, particularly in the capital cities where it's tightly held, high owner-occupied, you don't always pick up that element of it. And I think that there's those that are in the market and those that are trying to get into the market, and you can't always separate the two.
Hmm. Just nod to that one.
No.
Last question, please, ladies and
gentlemen. Keith, my students. Can you mention much interest rates? Where does the RBA see them heading? What impact will that have on the Aussie dollar? Will that help with foreign investment? Will that help with first home buyers and greenfield sites?
Well, interest rates, I guess, was are underpinning the decline here in the payments that are required on a new home loan. So that movement there, you can also see the sharp drop in interest rates around 2009. Rates were normalised. Rates have been cut again over the past year or so. So that's what underpins this, and I think that's providing an element of support to the housing market and likely to be driving investment in the way I've described. But I wasn't sure what the question was specifically about the... Oh, well, that's an excellent question. That's the one that people, I would have thought, start with that question. That's a good question. I mean, the market sort of perception of where interest rates, you know, are heading, they don't price in much more of a cut this year. The latest statement by the governor after the past board meeting said that the outlook for inflation, as we currently assess it, that provides scope for further easing, should that be necessary. And I think that's the question, and that's the sort of thing that we'll be sort of assessing data as it comes in and looking at things closely in the period ahead. So I don't know that I can add much to that. It's a good question. That's the biggie. So maybe that's a good one to finish on. Cheers.